Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things anti-nuclear. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when the nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we learn the shocking history of the Millstone Nuclear Power Station in Waterford, Connecticut, from Nancy Burton, founder of the Connecticut Coalition Against Millstone. Missing fuel rods, increased cancer rates, radioactive milk, and then on May 25th of this year, two emergency shutdowns and... Well, we'll let Nancy tell you the rest of what's been learned about that double emergency shutdown. Get all the dirt on the nuclear millstone of Millstone in just a few minutes. Plus, of course, we will have numbnuts of the week, activist shoutouts, and much, much more coming right up. Today is Tuesday, September 9, 2014, and here is the week's anti-nuclear news. Following up on last week's interview with Don Hancock on the latest developments following the waste isolation pilot plant nuclear accident on Valentine's Day, this in Carlsbad, New Mexico, word came on Friday, September 5th, that New Mexico's top environmental legislator has lashed out at the U.S. Department of Energy, accusing it of impeding the state's investigation into the circumstances that led to the radiation leak earlier this year at the WIPP site. At the annual Rad Waste Summit in Summerlin, Nevada, New Mexico Environment Department Secretary Ryan Flynn warned that the Los Alamos National Laboratory and WIPP could face steeper sanctions from the state because of what he characterized as Energy Department roadblocks that have protracted the probe. Flynn told reporter Patrick Malone of the Santa Fe New Mexican, "The problem is that the Department of Energy headquarters back in Washington, D.C. is looking at this situation through a political or public relations lens. So they put a noose around the scientific personnel who can answer our questions and move this process along." Flynn said that at times during the state's investigation into the leak, Los Alamos personnel have provided what he called outstanding communication about the possible cause of the radiation leaks. But when the Environment Department was asked for documentation supporting the scientists' observations, the Energy Department has repeatedly refused to provide it. Flynn said, "It would be interesting to know how many people need to sign off before someone at Los Alamos National Laboratory can return a phone call to me or one of my staffers." As if proving that point, on Friday, a Los Alamos spokesman referred all questions to Energy Department officials. Investigators have been unable to pinpoint what caused a drum of radioactive waste from Los Alamos to explode and leak in the underground repository for radioactive waste, the only one this country has, and the lab's review of the incident has led to uncertainty over the volatility of hundreds of other drums, including 86 still at Los Alamos. Speaking of waste, the U.S. Department of Energy failed to meet a deadline to begin emptying radioactive waste from a Hanford tank with an interior leak. The Energy Department discovered this leak in 2012. Radioactive waste was leaking from the interior shell of the repository into the space between the shells. This waste is left from past production of plutonium for nuclear weapons, which points to the fact that this stuff is forever. No word as to when the next false promise to clean up Hanford will be made. The Diablo Canyon Power Plant in Northern California published its annual Radiological Environmental Operating Report and reported that radiation from Fukushima has been found in the groundwater and food. Radioactive cesium-137, a marker for Fukushima, was found in 3 samples of market fish, milk, and vegetation throughout 2011, and they continued to detect cesium within groundwater, fish, vegetation, and meat throughout 2012. Isn't it special that they're finally letting us know in late 2014 what we were exposed to in 2011 and 2012, and those of us who were warning about it were called alarmists and told that we had nothing to worry about. There, there, don't worry your pretty little head about it. So with all the nuclear nonsense going on, heads up, Utah. Westinghouse and Blue Castle Holdings have signed a memorandum of understanding to pursue the development of a 2-unit nuclear power plant at the Green River site in Utah. Get your petitions ready and start organizing now. The Gray Lady herself, the New York Times, ran a curious article on the rising incidence of thyroid cancer. It echoes precisely the argument that has been used in Japan to discount all the cases of thyroid cancer coming up in the children of the Fukushima prefecture, saying that by them getting tested, it's increasing the incidence of cancer because they're looking for it so thoroughly. To which Nuclear Hot Seat replies, "What?" Even stranger is this paragraph written in the article by Carolyn Sayer. Quote, "Physicians are fairly clueless about what else could account for this mysterious rise in incidence. Exposure to radiation from the Chernobyl nuclear power plant accident in 1986 and radioactive fallout from nuclear weapons testing in the 1950s have long been linked to thyroid cancer, but they would not account for all the new cases." End quote. They seem incapable of saying the F word. Fukushima. And I'm shocked that this kind of obfuscating article would come out of the United States' newspaper of record. Let's take this international. 55 Greenpeace activists from 20 countries went on trial in France on Thursday, September 4th, for their courageous, audacious, and totally awesome break-in at the country's oldest nuclear power plant, this to highlight weaknesses at atomic installations. The March 18 protest at the Fessenheim power plant in eastern France, near the border with Germany and Switzerland, included activists from Germany, Italy, France, Turkey, Austria, Australia, Hungary, and Israel, as well as several other nations. About 20 activists managed to get onto the dome of one of the reactors, and another group of Greenpeace activists put up a giant banner next to the nearby Rhine Canal, which read, "Future is renewable. Stop nuclear." Fessenheim is located on the banks of the Rhine River and is considered vulnerable to seismic activity and flooding. And now, Greenpeace activists. More from Greenpeace. Europe's largest nuclear power plant is vulnerable to direct bombardment in Ukraine, between Ukraine and Russia. Greenpeace nuclear energy expert Tobias Munchmeier said the 6-reactor Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in eastern Ukraine was insufficiently protected against a direct bombardment and that 1.2-meter-thick reinforced concrete shells surrounding each reactor are strong enough to withstand only a small aircraft crash. Even more frightening, the Soviet-designed reactors at Zaporizhia are largely dependent on Russian expertise and spare parts in order to keep functioning. Russia doesn't have to bombard the thing or put an attack on it. They just have to wait until it breaks down and not supply the needed parts. The reactors are only 200 kilometers, about 125 miles, from the war zone in Donetsk. The facility is currently being protected by the Ukrainian National Guard, whose corps includes members of the neo-Nazi Right Sector Group. And if that's not bad enough,
Nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, num-nuts out a week.
This one is no fun. Iranian authorities have arrested a Ukrainian national suspected of sabotage at that country's sole nuclear power plant. Hamshirai Daily, an Iranian newspaper, said the Ukrainian expert was affiliated with a Russian contractor who works in Iran's Bushehr nuclear power plant, which went online in 2011 with Russian aid. International sanctions force Iran to buy Western-made parts for its nuclear program from third parties. Hamshirai suggested such parties are involved in sabotaging parts before they arrive in Iran, but did not elaborate on that point. Hamshirai also quoted Asghar Zarian, deputy head of Iran's nuclear department in charge of security, as saying that Sandia National Laboratories, a New Mexico-based subsidiary of defense contractor Lockheed Martin, has been involved in manipulating parts that Iran needs for its nuclear facilities. So dig it. Iran has a reactor that is Russian-built but needs U.S. parts that can only be purchased aftermarket from third-party sellers. I wouldn't buy a used car from these guys, and they're dealing with the most powerful, the most dangerous technology on the planet. And just in the last week, the nuclear industry has been crowing because China's going to build a nuclear reactor in Canada. Russia's going to be building reactors for Algeria. These things are popping up all over the place. And yet, look at what's happening in Ukraine. Look what may have been happening in Iran. These are bombs on the ground. No delivery system needed. Just let them wear out. Hit them with a piece of military equipment that they can't resist. And there goes the neighborhood. And that's why the whole frickin' nuclear industry is this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat. None that's out of week.
A bit of a victory, at least for now, for Indian anti-nuclear activists led by Kumar Sundaram, who we've had a nuclear hot seat several times. And that is that the nuclear deal between Japan and India that was expected to go through as of September 1st did not happen, at least not this time. While Prime Minister Modi of India and Prime Minister Abe, baby of Japan, blah-blahed about important progress being made, the core issues remain persisting differences on the text of their nuclear deal, which they have been negotiating since 2010, so it's not likely to go through anytime soon. The key factor is that Japan so far has only inked nuclear deals with nations that are signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. India has not accepted either. Modi did, however, successfully sign a deal with Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott to import uranium from that country. Finally, in Germany, 28 years after the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, its effects are still being felt in the form of radioactive wild boar, which still roam the forests of Germany and are hunted for their meat, which is considered a delicacy. Since 2012, it's been compulsory for hunters to have wild boar they kill in Saxony tested for radiation. Carcasses that exceed the safe limit of 600 becquerels per kilogram have to be destroyed. That's six times over the limit in Japan. And in a single year, one-third of the boar tested in Saxony have been over the limit and had to be destroyed. Now for this week's interview. Nancy Burton is an anti-nuclear activist and founder of the Connecticut Coalition Against Millstone, which focuses on the Millstone Nuclear Power Station, located in southeastern Connecticut. Nancy has worked with whistleblowers, downwinders, and national experts to expose ongoing unsafe practices by the reactor's owner-operator, Dominion Resources. It is a tale worthy of an entire program's worth of numbnuts of the week. Give a listen to what Nancy Burton has to tell you about the Millstone of Millstone.
Nancy Burton, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
First, give people a sense of where the Millstone nuclear reactors are and the population density around it and those people who might be considered to be downwind of the facility.
Millstone is a three-reactor complex. One has been shut down, but two operating nuclear reactors located on the shoreline of the Long Island Sound in southeastern Connecticut, not very far from the Rhode Island border, not very far from New York State in terms of Fishers Island and also Long Island. And if you want to talk about population, let's talk about 50 miles downwind. And we all know the wind is highly variable. So within that 50-mile sweep, we bring in some major cities in the Northeast. Think of Hartford, Connecticut. Think of the outskirts of Providence, Rhode Island. Think of the east end of Long Island, which becomes so people-dense in the summertime. The 50-mile radius stretches that far as well. So we're talking about millions of people downwind of Millstone, potentially and every day, affected by the radiation releases of the plant and the risk of far worse.
Give us a sense, historically speaking, of some of the unsafe and illegal practices that Millstone has indulged in going back to actually the 1970s.
Well, we now know that during the 1970s, when Millstone was young and only Millstone 1 and 2 were operating, the company knowingly operated at 100% power for a long period of time with defective fuel rods. That means they had holes in them, and that means that radiation at excessive levels was released into the atmosphere. They never told us that, of course. Whenever there was an incident at Millstone back in those days, everything was fine. There was never any risk to the public, no public health issues involved. It was only later, when people began to take a closer look at Millstone, that these very scary facts came forward.
Has there ever been a reading of what that radiation was or what those radiation levels were?
There is a very good book I recommend. Mike Steinberg, who grew up in the area, has family who still live in the area, devoted himself to tracking down those numbers. And I can't give them to you off the top of my head. I don't want to be inaccurate. But he published a book called Millstone and Me, and it is jam-packed with that information. And I would suggest you not read it unless you're really prepared to be haunted by the specter of radioactivity.
I think listeners to Nuclear Hot Seat are brave enough. If you're strong enough to listen to this podcast every week, by God, you can read a book with some statistics in it.
I hope so.
Let's move on, because Millstone has certainly been egregious in its transgressions through the years. Millstone whistleblower disclosures of unsafe and illegal practices led to a two-year-long shutdown of its three nuclear reactors in the 1990s. Tell us about that one.
A nuclear engineer, George Galatas, courageously stepped forward with information that the owners of Millstone were routinely and knowingly breaking the rules that they were sworn to abide by, and by that I mean the federal license and federal regulations. And after he came forward, many others came forward, and George found himself on the cover of Time magazine, and Millstone found itself shut down for 2 years under orders of the NRC. And Millstone 1 never recovered from the shock of it. Unit 3 came back online first, but Unit 2 was considered by the Connecticut Department of Public Utility Control to be so fouled up that it was, in their words, no longer used and useful and should just be shut down. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. Although we were able to shut Unit 2 for 10 days during the springtime of 1998, I'll just digress here for a moment, over the issue of fish kills and fish larvae being sucked in by the billions into the intake structures. And we were able to persuade a Superior Court judge in Connecticut to keep Unit 2 shut down and not be allowed to reopen during a 10-day temporary restraining order period of time. Never happened before or since in any court in the United States of America. That was a single-time event.
Now, Millstone 2 became the nation's first nuclear power plant to have to shut down for 11 days for safety reasons 2 summers ago. And we covered this story on Nuclear Hot Seat. Tell us what happened with the water in Long Island Sound that shut down these nuclear reactors?
Well, it's happening not just in the Long Island Sound, of course. It's happening everywhere. And when Unit 2 was licensed by the NRC, it was given permission to operate only as long as the intake water from the Long Island Sound, which is the source of cooling water for Millstone, only as long as the temperature of that water did not exceed 75 degrees. That was the design limit for nuclear operations of that plant. And it just happened that 2 summers ago that the temperature did reach that level, and Unit 2 was shut down for almost 2 weeks. Wasn't contributing to the grid during the peak need for power in this area. The logical next step would have been just to shut Millstone Unit 2 because of the ever-increasing temperatures of the Long Island Sound. But instead, Dominion, the owner, went to the NRC and asked for an exemption from that rule and, in effect, a license amendment to allow it to take in water that reached 80 degrees Fahrenheit. And the NRC granted that amendment. Nothing changed in the plant, just there were calculations that were tweaked to make it safe suddenly. Millstone 2 graduated from an unsafe condition to a safe condition by virtue of engineers' pens and the rubber stamp of the NRC.
So the change was in the perception of danger as opposed to the reality of danger.
Well, when Millstone Unit 2 was originally licensed back in 1975 for operations, it was determined at that time that safe operation of that plant would be potentially compromised if the plant took in water that was hotter than 75 degrees. Are we smarter today? No, I don't think we are. We're just taking greater risks with very little participation by governmental figures who are supposed to be looking after our interests, and that's how they got away with it. But at the same time, they haven't completely gotten away with it because a Millstone also requires a federal Clean Water Act permit in order to withdraw all that hot water from the sound and pump it through its miles of tubes and coils and pipes, and finally to discharge it, you know, at an even hotter level into the Long Island Sound. And this permit is supposed to be renewed every 5 years. And the permit in Connecticut is considered by our state agency for environmental protection, the DEEP it's called. And so they shared jurisdiction over this issue with the NRC. And the way things turned out were problematical because Dominion told the DEEP that, yes, the water they would be releasing to the sound would be hotter. If it came in hotter, it would go out hotter. They admitted that. But they said, we don't need to amend our permit because we will stay within the parameters of our original permit. And they presented various pieces of data and information and some monitoring. But as the DEEP looked at it, you could almost feel them scoffing between the lines at the insufficiency of the information that was submitted, the blatant inadequacy of it, if not outright falsehood. Nevertheless, our Connecticut DEEP told Dominion that they needn't apply to amend their Clean Water Act permit, that they could just go ahead and use that hot water, even if it meant that a lobster die-off that has been identified here would continue. And even if biologists within the state's own fisheries agency, within the DEEP, have determined that a lobster die-off is not due to what many had said it was, which is the runoff of pesticides in the sound, but rather the heating of their environment, the heating up of the Long Island Sound. But that was not a factor that weighed very heavily into the DEEP decision, but there will be more on that subject later because the DEEP really is not allowed to accept an application that is so woefully insufficient and possibly deliberately misleading. So that story is developing.
this is a damning list of things that Dominion has done wrong, and we're not even halfway through the list bringing it up to the most current one. So let's loop this back to what one whistleblower told you about the response to a Department of Homeland Security directive that was given to Dominion for Millstone.
Well, it wasn't long after 9/11 that we heard from a whistleblower anonymously. He left us a telephone message, no way to contact him. And the message was rather dire because this was obviously a higher-level employee at Millstone who told us that the Department of Homeland Security, which had identified Millstone as Connecticut's first terrorist target, had been directed by the Department of Homeland Security to set up a floating barrier outside the Millstone intakes in order to deter a potential terrorist threat, to discourage sabotage, because the way the plant is situated on the Sound, the intakes are completely exposed. There's nothing to stop a person with evil design from doing potentially calamitous damage to those intakes. And for instance, the Navy has a sub-base not far away in New London, and it is surrounded by a floating barrier system for the very reason of deterring sabotage. So we were very concerned to hear this from the whistleblower. We contacted a congressman to verify it, and he contacted the Department of Homeland Security, and sure enough, it was true that the Department of Homeland Security had directed Millstone to do this. The taxpayers were going to pay for it, but Dominion said no. They simply said no. We are not doing that. And to this day, there is no barrier, floating or otherwise, that would impede or deter the kinds of people that we're talking about from inflicting egregious harm and damage to the pumps that operate the intake flow.
So Millstone is still without that free-floating security barrier. Tell Nuclear Hot Seat listeners about how Dominion dealt with perimeter security for the physical site on the land.
That's an equally scary story. Also after 9/11, we received a communication anonymously from a whistleblower who identified himself as a whistleblower at Millstone, a former worker there who had been fired, who informed us that Dominion, Millstone's owner, was routinely deactivating its perimeter security system. That's the fence around the whole plant site that's supposed to keep out the bad guys. And what was happening was that system was hypersensitive. And being along the coast, if it was especially windy, or a bird happened to alight on it, or leaves brushed against it, the alarm would sound. And under federal requirements, that meant that Dominion had to send out a person to go to the fence to determine whether or not there was a bad guy there trying to break through. And then the person would go back to a desk and write a report. Well, this was happening with such frequency that Dominion decided, rather than go through this ritual of sending out its workers to the fence, simply turn off the switch and deactivate the security perimeter fence around Millstone, believe it or not. And the whistleblower had heard about this he was in human resources. He heard about it from somebody who complained to him about the situation. He went and verified it for himself. He went to where the alarms come in, and he found out that this was true. And he made the fateful step of trying to have something done about it to correct it within the company, and he found himself without a job in a short time. That's when he contacted us. And the NRC would never verify whether what he said about the perimeter fence was true or not true. I'll leave it to you to imagine. But we were able to help this whistleblower get his job back, and we did that by introducing him to the Attorney General of the state, who got involved but then kind of let things drag, and we had to bring a lawsuit to get the state agency responsible for worker complaints like this to get moving. And as a result of that lawsuit, he did win his job back.
Much of the work that you have been able to achieve has been a result of your contact with Millstone whistleblowers. How do they know to contact you, and how do they know the best way to contact you?
That's a good question. The Connecticut Coalition Against Millstone, which I founded back in 1998, has a very strong track record of activity in the community. We have had many, many events, beach rallies. We've been involved in many, many, many proceedings at the state level, at the federal level. And we've had a lot of press conferences, and we've written letters to the editor. So we're quite well known, and we have established, I think, a good record of credibility. And for that reason, when workers within the plant who may love nuclear power, but they're dedicated to operating as safely as they can, when they grow frustrated with their profit-minded boss or the NRC, we've been there to provide an outlet for them. And they have known, based on the results that occurred, that we're a good place to go to. And we have a website. It's www.mothballmillstone.org, where we have documented much of this information.
This is an incredible story, and it's not done yet. We're bringing this into the present. This one blew me away and has the potential to literally blow a lot of people away at some time. It almost sounds like a bad bedtime story. Tell us about Dominion and the missing fuel rods.
We were involved in intervening in a case where they wanted to expand the storage capacity of the Millstone 3 spent fuel pool because they were running out of space. Rather than shut down, they wanted to expand the storage capacity. And we happened to come across at that time in our researches a rather obscure notice from the NRC that Millstone's owners could not account for two pins. That's the word they used, pins. When you think pin, you may think, oh, safety pin or something like that. But actually, pin is nuke speak for high-level spent nuclear waste, spent fuel rod, a big difference. I think they didn't want us to know that, which is why they called it pins. And upon our further and deeper look into this, it turned out that they could not account for two spent fuel rods in a spent fuel pool at Millstone. And, of course, this is the ultimate betrayal of the public trust. We allow a profit-seeking company to use the most deadly materials known to man, which are man-made, and they pledge to us that they will safeguard them so that we won't need to worry that they might lose them, or they might harm us, or they might fall into the hands of people or entities who would make ill use of them. They broke that bond. And we broke the story, and it became a very, very big media story that was widely reported. And it led to a special investigation by the NRC, during which they still couldn't find the spent fuel rods. Nobody knows where they are. And rather than shut the plant down for this terrible, ultimate type of breach, they simply fined the company a paltry sum of money and let them carry on.
You know, some of the short-sightedness in this industry continues to floor me on a weekly basis. It's one of the reasons I do this show. Every spent fuel rod ever taken out of a nuclear reactor contains weapons-grade plutonium. So the fact that two fuel rods with weapons-grade plutonium are missing in a plant that has no security on the ocean side and for a period of time was turning off its perimeter fence security does not bode well for the future of any of us.
I couldn't agree more.
So let's bring this up to May 25th of this year, 2014. When both reactor units at Millstone went into a simultaneous emergency shutdown, which we have been covering on Nuclear Hot Seat. Now, Dominion told the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission that its on-site radiation monitors, quote, are indicating normal levels. And the NRC's public affairs officer, Neil Sheehan, assured Connecticut news media, quote, all safety systems function as designed, and there were no health or safety issues to the public. Yet, only 3 months later, the NRC has released its special inspection report, finding, among other things, that Dominion committed a violation of federal regulations, which led to the shutdown, and they were committed at a level 2 on a scale of 4. So halfway to the top, this was not minor, this was already up the scale. And more importantly, buried in the inspection report from the NRC dated August 28th and completely unreported by mainstream news media is the previously withheld information that cascading equipment errors led to, quote-unquote, unexpected radioactive gaseous releases through the reactor's ventilation system and elsewhere at Unit 3. In other words, if I'm reading this correctly, was there a radiation release into the environment as a result of what happened on May 25th of this year?
At least according to the special inspectors who spent quite a lot of time there assessing the situation, they took care to bury that information at page 16 of their report. And I don't think very many news media people perhaps read that far. But isn't this taking us back to the 1970s when big bad releases were happening, but we were told everything was okay. There was never any threat to public health or safety. That's the tune that they are still singing. And it's worse than that because even reading the special inspection report, you can't get a very good idea of how serious this was. We know the event was classified as an emergency, as you mentioned, number 2 on a scale of 4, pretty serious stuff. What was also revealed by the inspectors was that it apparently resulted from a reckless move on Dominion's part to remove a critical safety barrier so that they were not in compliance with their license. And they have to notify the NRC when they are preparing to do something like that. They have to get approval for it, and they did not do that. That's partly what makes this so very serious, because I don't want to equate this with Chernobyl, but let's remember a rogue experiment was going on there that was not authorized that led to that catastrophe, human error. And we still don't know as much as we need to about what happened at Millstone. But what is very discouraging is a statement also in the report by the inspectors that the public will have a chance in a year. That is next April 2015, a year after this event, to have a better understanding about the true nature of the radioactive release, because that's when Dominion is scheduled to release its annual radiological effluence report.
As we heard on Nuclear Hot Seat number 164, which was originally online as of August 12th, Dr. Ian Fairley, in putting together his study of more than 60 studies of radiation releases and leukemia rates in children around nuclear reactors, pointed out that one of the games the nuclear industry plays is that they release annual radiation figures, which do not reflect the intensity of a particular release when it happens. He was talking about the radiation spikes that happen when fuel rods are being swapped out as being the major portion of the radiation load that will happen in the course of a year. But of course, by averaging it out over the year, it looks like a very small amount, as opposed to you got most of it within this 12 to 24 to 36 hour period of time. And it sounds like that's what Dominion is counting on happening here by waiting until next April and giving their annual figures as opposed to what happened within this very short and very specific period of time.
That may well be. And at the same time, Millstone has been suffering a series of problems with its radiation monitors. They keep being shut down for maintenance in ways that are requiring them to report to the NRC, and we keep seeing these event reports. we're developing information about this, but on the point you just made, I'd like to direct your listeners to Dominion's own website, which I just looked at recently again. If you go to DOM.com, as a result of my coalition's efforts, the state of Connecticut enacted a law in 2008 requiring Dominion to post notice on that website in advance of planned releases of radioactivity with various details. So I went there today before this interview just to see what the latest was, and listen to this. In April of this year, Unit 2 was having one of these refueling outages, and the reason that the radioactivity levels are so high is that these companies postpone a lot of their maintenance until a refueling outage. In the old days, they used to shut down and fix the problems as they arose, but now, as they're deregulated, it's a race to the bottom line and a race to the next refueling outage, if they can make it that far, to take care of some of their buildups of problems. And they open their vents, they clean out the systems. It's a time to, that's why there are these high levels of releases to the atmosphere. Well, if you go to the Dominion website today, you'll see that they projected that during the April 2014 refueling outage at Unit 2, on the graph, the numbers would spike. That would be the highest time during the year of radioactive releases. But they haven't put on that chart what they actually released. And now it's August. They know what they actually released at that time. And it needs to be understood that there's a term of art involved here in terms of what they know about their releases, because very much of the information they generate on their radiological releases is based on modeling, estimates, projections, samples. And if they happen to sample for a release before the release or after the release in order to miss the full extent of the release, that information is impossible for the public to come by because they won't tell us. It will not be in that annual report that Dr. Frazier was speaking with you about. So it's a very, very pertinent reference that you've given us. Thank you.
With these ongoing and intermittent radiation releases that seem to have been going back now for as much as 40 years, might there be concerns about cancer showing up in the community that is in proximity to and downwind of Millstone?
Absolutely. And our community includes not just people, but animals. And I'd like to talk a little bit about Katie the goat, who lived in the early part of the 2000s on a farm about 5 miles northeast of Millstone. And she was milked there, and she ate pasture grass. She drank the water that came down in the rain. She breathed the same air that the community around her breathed. And on a regular basis, Dominion's technicians would come and collect a sample of her milk and test it for evidence of radioisotopes. It happened that Katie's milk tested super high for radioisotopes, particularly strontium-90, strontium-89, and the cesiums. And Dominion faithfully reported this information to the DEEP. It ended up in a filing cabinet. Nobody took a look at it. It was not disclosed to the public. And we only found it a few years later when we were joining the effort to block relicensing for Millstone. We spent a lot of time in the archives of the DEEP and came across this information. We had it looked at by some experts, and they couldn't believe the numbers. They said these numbers are higher. These numbers in the goat's milk, 5 miles from Millstone, are higher than the highest levels of strontium-90 in milk sold commercially in Connecticut during the peak of nuclear atmospheric weapons testing in the 1960s.
Wow.
So as a result of that, we took Katie to the Capitol, to Hartford, Connecticut. We had a press conference. We wanted to meet with the governor, and the governor wouldn't meet with us. But under media pressure, she ordered a study to be done of this very, very troubling fact. And the study came back under the name of Gina McCarthy, who's now the head of EPA for the United States of America.
And who is also responsible for the RadNet monitors not working when Fukushima happened.
I know that, too. At the time that Katie's press conference occurred, Gina McCarthy was serving as commissioner of Connecticut's Department of Environmental Protection. And in that position, she issued a report. And the report said that it is a matter of great concern that a goat living where she lives would have high levels of radioactivity in her milk. And she said, this is very troubling. However, there's only one thing that we're sure of, and that is that the contamination, the radiation, did not come from Millstone. We don't know where it came from, but we do know it did not come from Millstone. It wasn't long after that that Gina McCarthy was elevated to become the head of EPA for the United States of America. And you may be aware of the Inspector General's report at EPA that pointed the finger at her for the disgraceful condition of radiation monitors set up around the country that were relied upon by EPA to provide the public with an understanding about the Fukushima radiation fallout patterns.
Are there documented cases of cancer in proximity to Millstone, or is there a heightened awareness of the risks in the downwind community?
Unfortunately, Millstone may be responsible for a booming healthcare industry in New London County. It wasn't long ago that if you had cancer, there was just a small unit at the hospital there to go to. But over the years, they expanded to develop a special building elsewhere in the community to deal just with cancer. And very recently, both Yale New Haven Hospital, which is 50 miles away, and Boston's Dana-Farber Cancer Complex decided to set up satellite offices in New London just to deal with cancer patients in the area. So somebody is profiting from all of this. We have statistics from the Federal Center for Disease Control and also the National Cancer Institute that are very, very sobering. Let me give one. The cancer incidence for children age 0 to 14 has been 20% higher in New London County over any other county in the state, amounting to 50 cases between 2006 and 2010. And frankly, we're somewhat skeptical about those numbers because we are constantly hearing anecdotes of children who are afflicted. And then, as you might expect, thyroid cancer is 17% over other Connecticut counties. In other words, New London has the highest level of thyroid cancer. And we know that radiation exposure is an unquestioned, scientifically and medically, associated cause of thyroid cancer. And we've certainly been hearing about thyroid cancer incidences among the poor children of Japan after Fukushima.
What you've painted is a picture of something beyond corporate malfeasance into neglect and negligence that could seriously impact us for generations to come, beyond the generations that can possibly come, all because of Millstone nuclear power reactors. What can people do about this? What actions can they take?
Plenty. First of all, we are having an event. This is the Connecticut Coalition Against Millstone in East Lyme, Connecticut, which is right next door to Millstone, on September 24th from 6 to 8 in the evening. You can get the details from our website. And this is an event that's titled, Has Millstone Been a Good Neighbor? Find Out. And we have the great good fortune to have as our special guest Jeffrey Szymancyk, who has just been appointed to be Connecticut's radiation protector for the public, for the whole state. He's going to come to this event, and Jeffrey has just left 20 years of serving as a nuclear engineer at Millstone after serving in the nuclear Navy, after having nuclear training. So we are very much looking forward to that event.
And what can people do if perhaps they can't get to this event? Perhaps they're not even in Connecticut, but they wish to support you in the work that you're doing.
I encourage everybody to go to our website, mothballmillstone.org. We have petitions there that you can sign. We have upcoming events that you can participate in. And we'd love to hear from you. Contact us. We have plenty of ideas of how all of you can get involved in helping us shut this nuclear menace.
Nancy Burton, founder of the Connecticut Coalition Against Millstone. Her group's website is mothballmillstone.org. We'll have a link to the full report that she referenced, Cancer and Birth Defects in New London County, up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 168. Hey, how about taking Nuclear Hot Seat out for a cup of coffee? Not literally, of course. Neither the show nor I need any more caffeine than we usually get on a Tuesday. But I'm thinking about that $5 that easily gets slapped down for a cup of coffee at Starbucks or Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf or any one of the big chains. You do that regularly, right? So how about doing that for Nuclear Hot Seat? What I ask is, this month, instead of a cup of coffee, send a donation. Donations are what keep this show alive and going and growing. You wouldn't believe my online charges for the last month. So help us out in whatever amount you possibly can. And yes, a cup of coffee's worth of donation would be just fine. You can donate by going to our homepage, nuclearhotseat.com. Scroll down just a little bit and you will find the big red donate button. Click on that. It takes you to PayPal. Everything's secure. And know that anything you give is really appreciated and really does support this programming. Many thanks. Activist shout out to the mother of us all, Dr. Helen Caldicott, who is on the march in advance of publication of her newest book, Crisis Without End, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Catastrophe. This is the book based on her March 2012 symposium of the same name, which brought together doctors, engineers, researchers, epidemiologists, and specialists in all areas of nuclear's impact on our lives and health, where they discussed what has genuinely happened to us and our planet as a result of the triple meltdown in Japan. Dr. Caldicott was recently in Moscow, where she spoke the truth about the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster to the Russian audience of Radio VR. This signals the start of her international book tour to promote, yes, the book, but especially the information that is in it. Official pub date is October, and you can pre-order Crisis Without End at your favorite small local bookstore, or, if you need to, from Amazon. Well, even if Jon Stewart isn't using that hashtag anymore, new CNN shows, I'm still aiming to be his nuclear pundit. So if you or anyone you know has a connection to John, to his program team, his directors, how about his mother? Any of the above, and can put me in touch. Let's let him know that nuclear deserves to be covered on his show, and I'm the one to do it, if not being on, at least to provide the written material so his team can take it and run. We'll have a link to John up on the website, NuclearHotSeat.com. Here's today's final thought. A friend of mine who is a brilliant energy healer recently introduced me to the concept of hungry ghosts. That's a term she uses for energetic patterns of thought and behavior that remain in place by habit, even though we no longer have a need for them. Hungry ghosts are usually fear-based, rooted in trauma, and kept in place because we're terrified of losing something so familiar in the name of risking something that's unknown, even if it might be more comfortable or at least make more sense. It's like the child of the Depression who grows up unable to spend money on themselves even if they're now rich. Or the abuse survivor still terrified of a perpetrator who's been dead for decades. We continue to feed these hungry ghosts because we're so used to them. We cannot imagine life without them. They become a core belief we fight to keep in place because we don't know who we'd be without them. I believe that nuclear is a hungry ghost. We as a people fell into a pattern of thinking that once we'd created such an unprecedented, overwhelming power, we had to keep using it. President Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace program put in place in our society the belief that nuclear was the way of the future, of energy too cheap to meter, of power that would allow our country to keep the world safe. The truth has proven to be much different. And now we know there are ways to generate energy that are sustainable, renewable, safer, and much more cost-effective. So why don't we move in that logical, sane direction? Government, industry, business, the power structure that grew up around nuclear will not move from their entrenched position. Giving up on this belief feels impossible. This change feels like death. Of course, a lot of this resistance has to do with the unbelievable amounts of money generated by the industry. Money is its own addiction. But the rationalization, the justification for this nightmare technology is a hungry ghost, consisting of old beliefs, old concepts, habits, and the fear of change. And these ghosts are more than hungry. They're ravenous. They are insatiable. They will never stop demanding that we feed them. Until we realize that they are just ghosts. Insubstantial beliefs, not of this world. A no longer useful concept. A worn out idea. If we don't give these thoughts our energy, they have none of their own. So maybe as a movement, our message to the world and its governments and its industry needs to be, stop believing in nuclear. It is not a god. It is not a savior. It will not make you an independent world power when you buy that reactor from China or Russia or the U.S. If anything, nuclear is a devil, promising the eternal hellfire and damnation of the chain reaction, the eternal hell of radioactivity, with a half-life of forever. We feed this ghost's hunger at our own peril. We do not need nuclear. We are better off without it. It's time to let this pattern go. Let the nuclear ghosts starve to death. It's time. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, September 9, 2014. Material for this week's program has been researched and compiled from enenews.com, en.ria.ru, Santa Fe, New Mexican, and their excellent reporter, Patrick Malone, krem.com, Sacramento Bee, nuclearenergyinsider.com, New York Times, our friend Deun Renard and his blog, dunrenard.wordpress.com, Dianuke.org, Anti-Nuclear Alliance of Western Australia, znews.india.com, rt.com, World Nuclear News, telegraph.co.uk, and the very sexy Nuclear Hot Seat Facebook community. I thought if I referred to you guys as sexy, it would boost our subscription numbers. But whether we're sexy or not, join us, friend us, tweet to Jon Stewart about us, come join the anti-nuclear party, the water's just fine. Theme music written by me, sung by Marilee Weber. Looks like Weber, sounds like Weber. Nuclear Hot Seat is syndicated by UCY.TV and is also available on airprogressive.com. Our archive is available on iTunes. You can subscribe under podcast and on the searchable website, nuclearhotseat.com. Nuclear Hot Seat is the activist voice on nuclear issues, So if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. We are copyright 2014 Libby Halevy and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed for nonprofit groups, blogs, and websites. You have my personal permission to reuse this as long as proper attribution is provided, consisting of my name and the website. If you are a for-profit broadcaster or other news site, let's talk. I'm reasonable, as long as you're not pro-nuclear. This is Libby Halevy of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that we've all had our nuclear wake-up call. Now, do not go back to sleep, because we are all of us in the nuclear hot seat.